There was a great famine in the animal kingdom. They knew they had to do something quickly or else they would all die off. So it was decided that all of the mothers would be sacrificed and they would eat the mothers. The dog, who was at this meeting, decided that he was not going to sacrifice his mother, so he hid her in the sky. Every day, he would go to a particular spot where he sang a song for his mother to drop a rope. His mother would drop the rope, and he would climb up to the sky where she'd have a big feast for him. Well, one day, the tortoise saw this happen, and the next day, he disguised his voice to sound like the dog's, and the mother dropped the rope, and the tortoise started to climb up, but the dog saw this just in time and warned his mother, so his mother cut the rope. The tortoise dropped to the ground, and his shell smashed. So Omar, the man, the person on whom this opera is based, was from the Fulani people of West Africa. Their literary production is extremely rich in oral forms, dominated by poetry and epic tales and storytelling, much like the story I just told you. Before I go on, I should introduce myself. I'm Michael Muhammad. I'm part of the Black Opera Research Network. I also teach down the street at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music and down the road at the San Jose State University Music Department. I'm also on faculty at the San Francisco Community Center and the American Conservatory Theater. Today, I am wanting to start from the place where the opera actually ends, which is Omar's autobiography. Much of what we know about Omar ibn Said comes from his writings and specifically from his autobiography. Before and after his death, many people took note of his life, religious leaders, abolitionists, academics. They all looked at his life through their own white ideological lens to defend slavery, or to abhor slavery, or even to support sending enslaved Africans to Africa. One of the interesting points of the autobiography is that Omar wrote it in Arabic. Islamic culture is part of the wisdom traditions of West African society, including using Arabic characters to write local languages called Ajani. He includes Ajani to adapt sounds in English not found in standard Arabic. So keep in mind, white American scholars during this time knew Arabic script for means of translation only. There was little regard for cultural context, which really exacerbates the Eurocentric prejudice against Islamic peoples and their culture, as Edward Said would later write in his 1978 book, Orientalism. Also, Islamic cultures in Africa frequently incorporated non-Muslim African traditions. For example, in other writings, Omar illuminates his text with drawings of symbols. He creates geometric patterns often seen in Islamic texts that derive from highly developed designs throughout West Africa. These embody a non-verbal communicative and aesthetic values and usually has rich proverbial meanings from local indigenous communities and spirituality. So as far as we know, Omar's is the only slave narrative written in Arabic and to include these specifically West African traditions. So this begs a few questions. Who does this narrative serve, and what does Omar want us to know? Henry Louis Gates Jr. names the complex relationship between literal and figurative meanings in Black verbal play with the term signifying, with a capital S and an apostrophe. In literary criticism, this would be considered a Black-specific form of double-voiced discourse, or expressing a particular opinion, and at the same time adjusting the way that the author speaks in order to take into account their counterpart's views and concerns. For example, as Dorian Corey states in the documentary about the New York drag scene in the 1980s, Paris is Burning, when describing shade, shade is, I don't tell you you're ugly, but I don't have to tell you because you know you're ugly, and that's shade. Since slavery, African Americans have developed covert ways of communication, which over time have morphed into traditional ways that they interact with one another. And as for that tortoise who shattered his shell, he managed to glue the pieces together, but was never able to fully close up all of the cracks. And let's think about Omar's autobiography in the same vein. What he did not write is just as important as what he did. So we have to look inside the cracks to understand more deeply the meaning behind what he says. Omar writes his autobiography in Arabic, remember that, which is outside of the common language where he is. Yet he writes, "I cannot write my life. I forget too much about my language and the Arabic language." But this is after a direct transcription of the 67th surah of the Quran. He also quotes two Arabic grammarians, two Sufi mystics, and three Muslim theologians, all most likely from memory. When he uses the term divine guidance in his writing, white Christians could see this as an affirmation of their religion, even though it could also be seen as an ambiguous cover to his continued loyalty to Islam. Even outside of writing in English, Omar knew he had to be careful with what he wrote, so ambiguity was a way of subversion. He almost must have been sending out a message that would be palatable to those who would read the translation and understandable to an audience that would be distant from him. In the statement, "I cannot write my life," we have to be curious about the author writing as a reflection, or is he writing as a projection? The document can be seen as an embodied archive of the real and the imagined. Many of the things we see in this opera are also in the autobiography. We can take these things for a given. He was born around 1765 in an area that we now know as Senegal. He studied for 20 plus years at an Islamic academic institution away from his homeland. He was captured and sold into the transatlantic slave trade around the age of 37. Scholars estimate that the slave ship that brought Omar to Charleston, South Carolina, landed in 1807. Since the United States abolished the transatlantic slave trade soon after, Omar was probably on one of the last legal influxes of Africans sold into slavery, and he died the year before slavery was abolished. This past summer, I personally was in Ghana to present at a conference, and while I was there, I visited three of the principal depots, often called the slave castles, that held enslaved persons from across Africa. Between the 16th and 19th centuries, this was their final stopping point before they were loaded onto ships to cross the Atlantic Ocean. As someone myself with African heritage, with parents from the Caribbean, and I grew up in the US, it felt like a transcendent experience. I kept having the impulse to touch the walls and smell the air, anything, any of my faculties I wanted to engage with, knowing that the remains of some of these ancestors still lay underneath my feet. At one point, the guide closed the door and shut off the flashlight so we could experience the utter darkness that these people would experience, possibly for months at a time, while they waited to be loaded onto the ships like cargo. As a student of history, I had only imagined what these places would be like. Experiencing the conditions in person is something completely different, something a photo cannot show. So at this point, let's hear a little bit from the opera. This is a chorus of the enslaved workers who Omar hears as he's figuring out his place in this new world that he finds himself. Clip number one, please. Near the end of the autobiography, he writes, "I reside in our country by reason of great harm." There is no ambiguity about his opinion about the machinations that forced him into his position. In this sentiment, we understand the distress with his life. In the original manuscript, Omar writes his introduction, then leaves 8 pages blank. Are these blank pages a sort of protest? "I cannot write my life." I'd like to look at this as a choice that the writer puts on the reader to put us into a discomfort. Omar might be using the unwritten page as a way to portray his life through the limitations of slavery and engage with a type of transcendence. His story in relation to himself with the world in which he lived, as well as his relationship to others. When we look at Omar's autobiography, we see it not just as a reflection of the past, but also as a discussion of his conditions in which he found himself. "I cannot write my life." So we can only imagine what was the nature of his situation at the time. Much of what we came to know about Omar during his lifetime was from supporters of slavery who used him as an example of how one might thrive under slavery, particularly through Christian conversion. But his writings need to be understood from his positioning. For example, Omar had been asked to write the Lord's Prayer in Arabic. But in fact, he included a verse from the Quran that has similar sentiments about forgiveness. So it seems as if he's following the rules of the master to gain legitimacy, all while subverting them. He may have been writing about his own placement in slavery rather than a declaration of conversion. In the following musical clip, we hear Omar working through his turmoil as he tries to figure out his fate. Clip number 2, please.
I know now, I know, when knowing is too late. This I hear, now I hear, the drumming of my fate.
And let's take a moment to shout out Jemez McCorkle, who amazingly leads this cast of extraordinary performers. Omar, the opera, as far as I can tell, marks the first opera at San Francisco Opera by Black composers in its 101-year history. When speaking of firsts in the 21st century, it's important to ask, why are these firsts? What has actually been going on all these years beforehand? How can we look at the roots of what makes this possible? Firsts reflect not only remarkable individual achievement, but also an indication of the progress, or lack thereof, of Black people in realizing the centuries-old goals of justice, inclusion, and liberation. One of the things that you may notice in this performance is that this opera is not some sort of trauma porn. It's not showcasing a group's pain in excessive amounts for the sake of entertainment. It shows the struggle of Omar, what he endures as contrast to his excellence. We see how he chooses to display his literacy. We see the wisdom of his mother, played by Taylor Raven, on both sides of the grave. Clip number 3, please. This production celebrates what exists in the story of Blackness in the U.S. and brings it into the light. Through the story of how free labor built this country on top of indigenous land, it also is envisioned on the scale that this story deserves. Opera insiders are well acquainted with the canon, the 20 or so unlimited unofficial list of operas that are produced over and over from top companies to regional companies, from recordings companies to publishing houses, from film companies to online streaming. The confluences of the economics of opera productions and subsidies and the social makeup of opera audiences create the environment for a fixed repertory of classic works. Surely our fair opera house here in the city by the bay has conversations around this with every ensuing season. One way to deconstruct this art without surrendering debate is by simply doing as we are doing today, adding in robust new works with creators with minoritized identities. We can engage with the canon with its blind spots by not forgetting our roots and starting with what we know. Opera is a kinetic art form that has scale and breadth to tell deeply provocative stories. The definition of opera that I like to be using lately is a theatrical musical form using dynamic vocalism as its primary means of storytelling. As you may know, this opera won the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for Music. The website states, the rich, bubbling score combines West African traditions and traditional opera instrumentation to illuminate the lives of Omar Ibn Said and those who came into his orbit. Most discussions around the aesthetics of Western lyric music include that of blended sound when several instruments perform simultaneously, resulting in a homogeneous texture. The essence of Black music traditions is comprised of the following. Organization is based on rhythmic and metrical contrast. Singing and playing instruments are performed in percussive manners. There's a high density of musical events occurring in a short amount of musical time. And physical body motion is integral into the music-making process. The language of Black music, which includes dissonant harmonies, non-harmonic tones, syncopations, disrupts traditional notions of Western musical aesthetics. I believe you will definitely hear how the range of the sonic elements constructs the wholeness of this piece, by how the composers use all musical and theatrical traditions available to them. In the following dance music, you can get a sense of the colliding musical styles. Clip number 4, please. Just makes you want to frolic, doesn't it? You're going to hear the singers use this medium of opera in a range of vocal nuances through the prism of cultural influences, not limited by the opera industry or societal standards. In fact, what you hear only adds to the sonic palette of the operatic voice. Additionally, this production feels like a holistic, extravagant sensation. You will see fabrics on which are printed Omar's writings and drawings. Director Kaneza Shaw says that the production is holding Omar's contest of languages, and he holds everything at once. In the following clip, Jenny, played by soprano Brittany Renee, encourages Omar to hold on to his memories like she has had to do. Clip number 5, please.
So, remember it all. I do.
The entire production becomes a means of transmission of distinct traditions from across the African diaspora through covert responses and reconfigurations. Complex questions that cannot be answered adequately within the boundaries of a given discipline. Therefore, this opera works as a discussion, as an active process evolving from crossing and colliding disciplines. But that is why we keep returning to opera, isn't it? For Richard Wagner's conception of the Gesamtkunstwerk, the all-embracing art form that strives to use as many art forms as possible. And I want to leave you with one more thought. Disruption as the site where subversion can happen. Though Omar could not directly control his environment or situation, he wrote his story, leaving a trail of clues, some blatant and obvious and many subtly hidden. Rhiannon Giddens and Michael Abels take this essential art form of opera and infuse its music with Black musical signifiers that interrupt more widely accepted European aesthetics. All of these artists interrupt the perceived universality of the Western knowledge and of the superiority of Western culture by centering other ways of knowing and being. So you didn't realize that coming to the opera today was going to be subversive, did you? Thank you so much for listening. Again, my name is Michael Muhammad, and please enjoy Omar.